Danny writes widely on inequality and injustice, wealth and poverty, housing, health, employment and education. Much of Danny's work is available on his website or indeed from bookshops, where his books are popular, informative and remain long in print. Some recent ones include Geography, Ideas in Profile, A Better Politics, How Government Can Make Us Happier. I look forward to actually having a look at that. People and Places, A 21st Century Atlas of the UK. Injustice, Why Social Inequality Still Persists. Inequality and the 1%. All That Is Solid, The Great Housing Disaster. Well, we're still experiencing much of that. And so when Danny speaks to us in a moment, we look forward, all of us, I think, to hearing what we can do to make things better, to build better cities. So without further ado, can I, on your behalf, offer a very warm welcome to Danny Dawling, and we look forward to hearing you say.
Thank you very much for that. I'm going to speak to about 1:30 the hour, in case you begin to get bored and wonder how this is going to go on. I'm rather hoping we're going to get some sound effects. We've already had some about cities. Quite how we got speeding motorbikes, well, the traffic moving so slowly, I don't know. And sirens as well. That gives you a clue as to where I'm going to end up with this talk. I have to recommend the Human City Manifesto, which will be on the website tomorrow, because it's upbeat. I'm afraid quite a lot of what I've got to say will not be so upbeat. It really is quite a fascinating document, particularly in these times, and it should give you hope, so that's a good recommendation for you. This is my favourite picture of a city. It's by Escher. It looks a bit like a kind of Tuscan hill city. You kind of wonder how they managed to build the houses then, given how hard we find to do it nowadays. The other thing I think when I see that city is questions about inequality in the slopes and the different gaps between people. In the past, we built our cities around religious centres. And in a way, we've still got those centres now, but we just don't know what to do with them because the people don't go anymore. When I was doing a PhD in the very late 1980s, I read somewhere, it might have been a report from Kurz, that the sharpest social divide of any city in the UK was in Birmingham. The biggest gap between the rich and the poor, the shortest distance you had to travel to go from one extreme to another. And so I put that in my PhD thesis. And then I moved city and went somewhere else, and I found out that in fact there was another city which had the sharpest social divide. And I moved again, and 25, 27 years on, I've come to work out that all UK cities have similar social slopes in them, which does limit what you can actually do in any one city. And the social slopes in our cities are steeper than the social divides between cities in Germany or cities in France. So when government tells you to sort yourself out, you need to talk to governments back again and tell them to sort themselves out and educate themselves a little bit, because no amount of powerhouse or devolution is going to solve some of these particular problems. Some reasons for optimism. The slides, I will describe them, they're really a comfort blanket for me. They stop you looking at me. Overestimate how much we know or how much we should know. This is a map of the world. Those lines are the briefest summary you can give of human migration since human beings started being human beings. For the vast majority of our history, we wandered about. We were migrants. We still are migrants. Humans naturally migrate. Some of us don't learn that. Find it hard to understand, but we're a species that migrate and move. We then settled and farmed. Hardly any of us lived in cities. The majority of people who've ever lived in a city the size of Birmingham and above are alive today. There are good reasons as to why we are not getting this right, because it is so relatively recent. Here's Kartalhulik. Kartalhulik's in what is now Turkey, one of the world's very first cities, possibly 9,000 years old, 10,000 years old. It's small. You can see the scale there. If you're at the front, you can see the scale. If you're at the back, you just have to believe me, which helps a lot for some of the assertions I want to make later. It's small. You might notice it's slightly odd. It doesn't have any roads. To get to your house, you walked over other people's roofs, which sounds quite nice until the city gets a bit bigger, and then they're looking annoying. Everything about cities has to be discovered and invented. You might think, oh well, we invented roads and alleyways quite some time ago. But think about sewers. Sewers really is only 170, 180 years ago. And we still haven't worked out how to get human beings around the city. Just, if you get bored of me and the slides, just look out at the speed of which we're moving people around in a ton of steel and glass in the most dangerous way we can in this city. The biggest killer of people aged between 5 and 25 in the country is cars. Here's the city I grew up in and the city I now live, it's Oxford. And if you look at 1750 or 1830, the centre of it isn't much bigger than Kartalhulik 9,000 years earlier. It really is true that large cities are a very, very recent thing. You can see the growing there. The yellow areas are the growth up to those years, in between the separate years that are shown. You can see the strangulation of the city from the late 1990s onwards. We have a special green belt designed to stop this largest city between the West Midlands and London getting any larger. We're still learning about green belts. We're still learning what kind of size a city should be, how people should get around within them. We do not actually know as much as we think we know. This cartoon is to save you from a dozen graphs. The cartoon is depicting two countries. One country has relatively narrow income inequalities. It's a country in which people live fairly equitable lives. Think Japan, think Norway, think Sweden, actually think Germany, think Switzerland, think most of the OECD, because compared to us, most of the OECD is relatively equitable. And have a look at their cities if you want an idea about what effect that has on them. Have a look at how people get around Tokyo, a city of 30 million people. They do it better than we do it here. Have a look at how people are housed in Northern Europe, how much they pay for their housing, the quality of the housing, how secure they feel in their housing. Have a look at the schools. We can learn from other places. I'm a geographer, so of course I'm going to say this, but it is, to me, frighteningly obvious. But it only became obvious recently, because it was only by the late 1980s and then the 1990s and 2000s that this country became so different from other countries in the OECD, and as inequalities between rich and poor grew so wide that we could actually see what the effect of that is. And you can see the effect in cartoon form there. Nobody wins. The people at the top of our ladder that gets exponentially steeper become more and more afraid of falling down. Somebody mentioned the budget earlier. I suspect Mr. Hammond would like to keep hold of his £9 million fortune. £9 million made, I think, mainly for providing private care homes and private nursing home provision. That's how our Chancellor got rich. It might be scary for him to think of having only 4 million, or 2 million, or 1 million, or imagine only having 500,000 wealth. Right. The more unequal a country you live in, the more frightening it is to think of yourself moving down. But of course, if people don't move down, nobody can move up, which is why social mobility is so low in a country like the UK. We are the most economically unequal country in Europe. Our 1% take about 14% of all income. our 10% take double that, which means that everybody in the 10% who's not in the 1% thinks they're being ripped off because they're taking so much less. They're only taking 14% shared out amongst 9 out of 10 of them. The 1% are taking just as much as those 9 people. And here I'm talking the best of 10. It's a mess. It's a terrible, terrible mess. That's something which has got slowly worse in this country. Here's something that gets rapidly worse. There are different patterns over time to these phenomena, which is partly why I don't think we should beat ourselves up so much about how we get into this mess, because they can suddenly come out of nowhere. This is Shelter's graph for the main reason that families, this is families with children, found themselves to be homeless up to the year 2015. And you'll see that suddenly after 2010, being evicted from an assured short-hold tenancy because you can't pay the rent because the rent's gone up has gone from being almost the lowest reason to the highest reason. Right? So you have a crisis you suddenly have to deal with of the way in which we legally allowed landlords to rent. I think it was pretty awful all the way from the 1980s Act, but it suddenly becomes an absolutely terrible disaster. I do have a few graphs, that's why I've shown you the cartoons to try and get them. You only have to look at the top line in this particular graph. This is data from every census from 1911 onwards. And the top line is about the inequality between the best housed tenth of the population, the tenth of the population who have the most rooms per person, and the worst housed tenth of the population. Now back in 1911, the best housed tenth had 4 times as many rooms per person as the worst housed tenth. So how many people here have been to the National Trust terraced houses in the middle of this city? A few of you? Right, feel guilty if you haven't and you live here. The job of the National Trust when it comes to houses is largely to take the mansions of the rich, pretend that they've been donated, they weren't. It's when we have decent inheritance tax, make them available to the public. The National Trust realised that you might get bored of going from one country house to another, and so they bought some old terraces in the middle of Birmingham. And they're terraces that were built at different times, and so you can see the social progress over time. And they tell you how many people were sleeping to a bedroom, how many children and adults there were. And when you go back to 1911 here, what this means is that the worst housed tenth of the population was sleeping 4 to a room, and the best housed tenth was sleeping 1 to a room. That got worse in 1921. Economic inequality also increased in 1921. 1913 was actually our worst year. And then it got better. 1931, 1951, 61, 71, 81. 81 was the peak of equality, the heady heights of utopia in Britain, when the best off 10th of the population only had 3 times as many rooms per person as the worst off 10th. Great equality doesn't mean some kind of socialist utopia. The most equal countries in the world still have large differences between rich and poor, but things are very different there. How did we manage to allocate our housing more fairly over those decades? Well, we built it. We built council housing. And you got it, and you got into it if you fitted in it. What happens if you sell the council housing? And then what happens if the people who buy the council housing go and sell it onto a private landlord? It gets rented out to whoever is willing to pay the most for it, which isn't a family with 2 children. It's one young professional really annoyed that they have to live in an ex-council maisonette on their own. And hence, you get that escalation up 2001, 2011, to the best off 10th of households having 5 times as many rooms per person as the worst off 10th of households. Now, it isn't just rising economic inequality, it is also ageing. When people live into their 80s and 90s and stay in the family house, and he dies, and it's normally him, and she stays around, that's one person in the house with many rooms. but why are they staying in the family house? And I'm afraid you get back to inequality again. She's staying in the family house. When you interview her, when you survey her, you find she actually doesn't like staying in the family house. It's hard to clean, it's cold, it's very hard to heat, but it's going up in value. So you hang on in there, because the longer you can sit in that house with three or four bedrooms, the better off your children and grandchildren will be. And that's only because we're an unequal country. A more equal country controls its house prices. It doesn't allow them to ever escalate. I'll let you read the quote about Germany. It could be Austria. Vienna's better than Germany. It could be France, could be the Netherlands, could be... I can give you examples of how people are housed. You've only got to basically... The trick is, go east, right? The mistake is to look west, right? Unfortunately, in Britain, we have tended to look to the US for policies of all kinds, which is a geographical error. Our new Prime Minister, she's still relatively new, has a degree in geography, not sure from where. You never know. You never know, she might begin to learn. I do like graphs too much. But one problem is, if you just say these things, you are automatically dismissed of, oh, that's just your opinion. These are graphs showing rates of self-reported health. They're not any old rates of self-reported health. They're the rates of self-reported health that are included in David Cameron's happiness index. How many of you remember the announcement of the happiness index in about 2010? We're going to measure happiness. How many of you remember it being announced every year how happy we were getting? It's a mess of about 30 odd statistics. The key one is the health one. The most important thing in life is your health. If you don't know it yet, you will, unless you're hit by a car. You will learn that it is the most important thing in life at some point in your life. And that shows the fall in self-reported health that there was 2010, 11, 12. The jump, we think, is because they switched from paper-based to computerized questionnaire, but it still doesn't matter. That's just 1 year. And I'll show you later why that rise matters. This is people saying that they're not feeling good about themselves and their life, having been asked as part of the survey, because the Prime Minister said that this was really, really important. And then we ignored them. We didn't look at what they said. These four graphs appeared about a week ago in that subversive publication, the Financial Times, in its dashboard of everything's going wrong, and for the Institute of Government. And it was on the news, I was watching the news earlier this evening, and we have had today announced the worst ever A&E figures from the National Health Service. A&E waiting times, discharges into social care, failures to recruit teachers, suicide, self-harming in prison. All the dials are turning red, all the graphs are going wrong. And there's much more to come. There are many more cuts to come. And I've only got a quarter of an hour left. but there's time for questions as well. It's hard. This is unprecedented. This kind of thing has not been seen at least since the 1930s. My own little contribution to this was to look at the rising deaths in 2015 as opposed to 2014. That graph shows you the rise by age. The older you are, the more likely you are to die a few years earlier. It's the frail who died. The list of dates down the side are the years in which we had the highest increases in death since we began recording deaths properly in about the 1830s. All the black ones are before 1940. They're flu epidemics, cholera epidemics. You have to go to 1951 before we find the first post-war one, which was a proper flu epidemic. 1968 was a flu pandemic, and then 2015. But if you actually go, this is calendar year to calendar, if you go mid-year to mid-year, 2015 was the biggest increase since 1940. which was the Luftwaffe and troops dying of their injuries having got back. It is unprecedented. The Department of Health still claim not a single person has died as a result of the cuts. Right, there will come a time when they stop saying that. We know there will come a time when they stop saying that because that looks really bad. But 2016 carried on being bad, and 2017, the first couple of weeks, are truly awful. There is a point when you can no longer say, move away, nothing to see. It's different elsewhere. Again, I'll let you read this if you've got very good eyesight. It's all about how great France is for its health service. The reason I was writing about France is because they've got an election coming up, and it's probably a particularly important election for Europe. Now, you can make excuses as to why, and I'll show you in a minute, why the US voted the way it did and why we voted the way we did in 2016. But the French don't have the same excuses. If you read in detail about how wonderful their health division is, let alone if you start looking at how much they pay for their housing and how good it is, before you even look at their median incomes, which are many thousands of euros higher a year per family than our median income is, we'd all be better off going to France, except of course we might have to come back in a couple of years. But we don't know it. We present France as an economic basket case. Occasionally you'll hear some left-wing commentator say everybody in France could stop working on the Friday and they'd still be more productive than us. So that's the only thing. That's the only thing you'll hear. Germany, of course, is better. Switzerland, in terms of how much it spends on health and what happens. Switzerland is even better. It spends twice as much on health care per head than we do. And Switzerland, I'm going to click past that one. Switzerland, it's not one of these kind of totemic Scandinavian countries. That's partly why we got into a problem. Here's a map of Europe. It's stretched so that areas are large, where there are many people, to stop you being obsessed by Scandinavia. It's too easy to be obsessed by Scandinavia. The areas, the cities and parts of the cities are coloured in by the immigration rate, the proportion of people living there who've crossed national border. And you can see that there are over 20% of Londoners who are immigrants from another country, but elsewhere in the UK, we're actually not that high. The mainland has much higher rates of immigration. Our problem was that we didn't have quite enough emigration. I don't think there's a problem. Well, you try and name somewhere in the world to which migrants have come. I don't know, California in the 1960s? Where life was terrible. In general, it's a good thing, but the purpose of that map is just to show you that it's easy to believe things until you see the data. The interesting one there for us, most interesting, is Spain. You have a look at Spain, and unlike most migration, which is to cities, the migration to Spain is to the coast, the costas, all those immigrants who've turned up on the coast in Spain. And they're quite elderly, they're not very productive. They do rely on a health service, and I'll leave that with you. Therefore, inequality. You may read that inequality has been falling since 1990, and that's by this measure, which has fallen again. And it's by the lower graph here, it's the quintile range. And it did peak in 1990. 1984. Some people my age and older might remember. 1984 was the time of great equality. Something happened in 1984, a particular battle which was lost. And you can see the thing zoom up till 1990. In 1990, something else historic happened. A certain prime minister went, and inequality between the quintiles then fell. Doesn't matter, because the graph above is showing you the take of the 1%. And the 1% are not included in the general statistics which compare quintiles because they don't fill in surveys. Right. Believe you, if you have that much money, you don't bother filling in a survey. We only know about the 1%, if I'm saying his name, because it's been recorded, from HMRC's here. We only know about the 1% from their taxes. So in fact, we only know their income that they admit to. And even that is the highest share in Europe. and our 1% are not particularly especially honest people compared to the rest of Europe. The drop's really interesting, by the way. The drop may be tax avoidance. I can go into it later, or it might be real. Around the world, we're beginning to see evidence of something happening. 2012-13. We might just be approaching peak inequality again worldwide as we last did in 1913. It's not necessarily great news. When you hit peak inequality and then equality begins to rise, nobody notices for 20 years. And things don't get much better for 20 years. You don't suddenly have parties in the street when the 1% take 1% less. And they normally take 1% less when the whole country becomes poorer. We're getting towards the end of the complicated graphs. This is a graph from The Economist. It's showing the rise in Republican voting by county and showing it's related to health. So The Economist looked at every possible explanation, every correlate, to try to understand why Trump won. And what they came down to was that people were more likely to vote Republican and to move their vote towards Republicans if they lived in a county in the US in which health was getting worse than the people around them. Not necessarily the people who voted Republican. They were predominantly white, better off, male. But around them, they were living in areas where they could see things falling apart, including life expectancy falling. So there's a connection between poor health in the US and inequality in the US, which is off the scale, and Trump's victory. In all of the OECD, there are only two countries which have falling life expectancies. The United States, and I'm 95% sure, the United Kingdom. We're just waiting for the data to be released. ONS has had cuts, so we can't even find out whether we're joining that particular club. There's the Brexit map for you. It's a different map from normal. I won't go into it in great detail because I really do want to give you time for questions. It told us things that we didn't know. And normally, elections and other kind of surveys and so on don't tell us much that we don't know. This thing, this told us about widespread dissatisfaction in parts of the country that we didn't think were dissatisfying. A majority of Leave voters live in the south of England. A majority are actually middle class, because middle class people are so much more likely to vote. Once you go out to the most prosperous parts of the south, you find majority Leave areas almost everywhere. Another quote for you to read. This is from a political scientist, but we're beginning to get this from economists. Where things are better planned, where governments spend more money rather than individuals, people are happier in rich countries. Where you leave more and more of it to individuals, their levels of happiness are lower. The 2016 World Happiness Survey was the most authoritative on this. Trying to work out why they're happier is harder. This little graph is showing you the share of income of the 1% along the bottom. So the US is the big circle there because it's 1% take the most. And along the side, the proportion of people who walk or cycle to work. And the proportion of people who walk or cycle to work is highest in the most equal countries, particularly in the Netherlands. It isn't directly because the 1% are not taking so much. It is because a country like the Netherlands controls its 1%. There'll always be greedy people. Leave them alone and they will get more and more. A country like the Netherlands controls its 1%, and it also designs its towns and cities so that you can live near enough to where you work, so you don't have to get in a car, and it builds cycle lanes so you can do that. In contrast, if we look west to the United States, and particularly if you look to Texas, there was a proposal a couple of decades ago now, I think it is. I used to say years on this story, but it's a couple of decades ago, to build some pavements in a town in Texas. And the mayor of the town stopped the pavements being built because pavements were the road to communism. What is that? It might sound absolutely mad to you, but the right way for freedom was to encourage people to get their car and go in their car and not provide pavements, but lower orders. I can give you more examples of those kind of things from the US. What really scares me is that if you're from the mainland of Europe, we must sound like people from Texas sound to us. But we may change that. Schools. Schools affect city policy. You'll worry about your schools. People are always trying to make their schools better to get better exam results for their schools. Again, along the bottom of this graph, we've got inequality. The further you are, I think, away from me, the higher the economic inequality. And along the side, you've got the PISA test results in maths. And this is of children aged about 15. And in the more unequal countries, kids are not so good at maths. You can test maths with an international test. It's roughly the same thing everywhere. Now that looks like a relationship, but it's not that good. What I want to show you next, same thing, same math test, same inequality measure on the bottom, but now we've tested people at maths aged 16 to 24. And now I did promise you questions, but we're actually going to give you all a math test to see how good you are. You won't be wondering, how come it lines up so much better when we test people a bit later rather than age 15? My best guess, I can't work out a way of proving this, let alone prove it, but I do have children who are taught maths in English schools. My best guess is that we teach maths to maximise your chance of getting a C, if you might get a D, on the day. Or to maximise your chance of getting an A or an A star, if you're a bit richer. Because it really matters. It matters from the point of view of getting a job. There are jobs you cannot have if you've got a great C at maths. And there are universities you cannot get into if you don't have an A or an A star. We've done this for so long and we've become so obsessed by it that we've long ago forgotten that getting a C or an A star at maths does not mean you're any good at maths. It means you're very good at jumping through the hoops you need to on that day. Whereas all those pluses of countries which are more human, which treat each other as human beings, which see other people in their cities as being like them, are somehow teaching their children something like maths in such a way that they still remember it when they're 24 years old. These are the kind of things that we should worry about. So don't just try to get your GCSE results up. Think a bit more about what you're really trying to do. There are a huge number of opportunities. There are huge differences between countries. This graph comes from the IMF, and it's a proportion of GDP being spent on public services over time. The UK figure, the IFS showed that we're actually going to increase taxation. The Conservatives have rolled back. Going to go from 36 to 37. That's the change of a little bit slower austerity. And just look what happens in Finland or France. Look what happens in Finland when GDP takes a hit and you have an almighty economic crash in the world. They tax people more so that public services don't have to be cut. Why didn't we think of that? Because we can't do maths. I won't go on about it, but if you want an excuse as to why it is so very hard, it's because you're living in a country that's down at the bottom with Ireland and the United States. You're not living in a normal place. And again, to save you any more graphs, just a picture. It isn't utopia in a more equal country. There are homeless people in more equal countries, just not as many of them. There are prisons, they're just not as full. There are hospitals, they're just less full. But we are in a strange position, and we have a strange acceptance of it. There are all kinds of things that we could begin to do, but they are largely national. They're largely national actions that we have to do. And there are all kinds of reasons why it'd be a good idea to begin to do this. It is not very exciting when you're a country at the bottom of the international league tables of rich countries just to say, go and look at what they do elsewhere and copy that. But unfortunately, if you are at the bottom of the class, and if you think of the rich countries of the OECD as a class of about 30 children, you know, us and the Americans are the dunces at the back. And the sensible thing, if you're the dunce, is to look at what everybody else is doing, not to come up with your own idea. Let's make the dunce great again. Really not a good idea. What's hard is what on earth do you do if you're Norway? Yeah, but we don't have to worry about that problem. But what do you do if you have the lowest rate of child poverty? What do you do if you're Finland with the world's most successful schools? It's only one way you can go if you're the world's number one for schools, isn't there? Not our problem. There's going to be trouble. There are studies showing that the more austerity and cuts you get, the more trouble you get of various kinds in social unrest and so on. There will be trouble. There's many things that we cannot predict, and we've learned not to predict things, but we'd be foolish to say we are surprised if there isn't trouble ahead. However, this is all very, very short term. Fortunately, it's the bulk of the rest of our lives for those of us who are old, but it is short term. If you want something to uplift yourselves, or if you're thinking of buying a birthday present for somebody, Alan Marshall's Ecotopia 2121 looks forward to the year 2121. And for the West Midlands, it has it covered in windmills. It's an eco-capital of the world, to do with the canals. This may sound utterly ridiculous, but this is over 100 years away. Think back just over 100 years from now to just before the First World War. Think about the slums around here. Think about the pollution. Think about the industry. Think about the ragged schools and then the beginning of the elementary schools. Think about the fact there were no secondary schools for those children. Think about the charity hospitals that a few could get and the very first inadequate housing associations before there was any council housing. And it was utterly different. And there were lots of terrible Irish immigrants. It wasn't that bad. It wasn't actually their fault that things were in that state. In fact, this place wouldn't have worked. It wouldn't be the West Midlands without the Irish. It's always funny with immigration. Nobody ever complains about an immigrant who came 15, 25 or 35 years ago. Do that and then look forward a generation, another generation, 100 years. And of course it's going to be depleted. And the one thing we can absolutely be almost absolutely sure of is that in a generation's time, we will no longer be the most economically unequal country in Europe, because it takes really hard work to keep that position. Some quite selfish, self-minded people have to work very, very hard to make the rest of the population not cotton on to what's going on, and they can't keep it up for that length of time. I've got four slides left for that version. Things you can do. This is cycling. This is a map of England. It's one of these strange maps, so I apologise for it, but we make things big where people live. Birmingham is the largest shape because it's got the most people of any local authority, district or borough in the country. And it's coloured a pale colour because cycling's neither gone up nor down in Birmingham. It's gone up in London, which is blue. It's gone up in Cambridge, which is dark blue. It's gone up in Oxford and Bristol. But in most of England, it's gone down. Right? People are still getting their first car, in some cases, and to be able to get rid of the bike. The differences across the country are quite amazing. But it's gone up in some areas. And there are things you can do. I won't suggest how you do it here, because I do not know here. But this is the city I know the best. It's Oxford. And this is where we could build cycle tracks out into the countryside, because Oxford has more bikes than almost anywhere else in the country, and there's nowhere they can go at weekends, because there's nowhere out of the city. I have suggestions for what you can do inside the city as well, to get up to the point where the majority of children can cycle. The cost of doing this has been worked out by the cycle activists of Oxford only yesterday, and the total cost of the most cycle superhighways and the rest of it you could want, kind of Copenhagen style, is 120 million over about 20 years. 120 million is nothing. In Oxford, we're about to spend exactly the same money, we're about 10 million off, £120 million, building a channel to take water from the Thames at the top of the city to the bottom of the city, so that Oxford doesn't flood, so we can flood Abingdon, Reading and West London. Now, if you can spend 120 million, you should see the houses on the banks of the Thames in West London. It's almost worth 120 million. It's just, there are lots of things you can do, but we may have to do things which are cheap in future, which might mean getting more people onto bikes, because it's cheaper to cycle than it is to drive a car. You can have bikes which are now electric, so many more people can do it. In the Netherlands, a quarter of pensioners cycle. In the UK, it's 1% of pensioners. My last slide. I hope you don't get this here yet. These are the signs that are put up by estate agents in Oxford to really scare the living daylights out of very affluent middle-aged people who are thinking of buying their first house. It isn't too late. But there are people who want you to think it is, think that nothing can change nationally, think there is no hope, think politics is only going to go in one direction, and then tell you you've got to do the best you can in the local area and it's just down to you. Now you have to do the best you can in the local area, but you should be telling people back that there are many, many alternatives. You can see them all across this continent. You can see them looking back at time in this country, and it's only a matter of time before we begin to head for those alternatives. The one perhaps useful thing about how we voted in 2016 is that it's going to be impossible to blame immigration in 2018, 2019 and 2020. We might try and find some other scapegoat to blame for our predicament, but at some point, the fact that we're ruled by people who've taken so much of the cake might become more evident to most people. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Danny. That was a really impressive lecture and very stimulating. I'm sure you've got some questions to come on to. I think at the start, Danny started off by showing us some history of cities, and what's interesting is how fairly recent it is that we are actually urban dwellers, but certainly urban dwellers we will remain, and linking into the Human City Manifesto, which we'll come on to in a bit. I think from my own perspective, from a housing association, I thought some of the points you were raising on affordable housing, how the links there with inequality, and that underpins quality of life in our cities, and that's obviously really important for the work we do. And it was interesting about tenure plays a fundamental role in perpetuating asset inequality, and we see that at the moment. Obviously, you had a balance of doom and gloom married with optimism, which was, albeit by 2021, we'll get there. And you highlighted some of the urban and housing policies that might address some of the issues that we face. So I think on that point, it's probably appropriate to open to the floor for questions. I think if we can take a couple at a time and Danny will respond.
I think I'm going to do a does the panel think question. Richard Tomlins, wearing a Industry Housing Association board member hat, and just teaching this afternoon at Coventry University on the social enterprise module. So I'm going to try and stitch those together with the knowledge that British Council see social enterprises, social value as a great British export, and we at the university are on a framework to deliver that work to other countries. One of the drivers around social enterprises, develop social enterprises and you'll get growth and you'll narrow inequalities at the same time. So I guess my two questions are, one, should the housing sector and housing associations do more in terms of facilitating and incubating social enterprises and play a role in changing inequality, and the wider social value point, should we, as the housing sector, do more to generate value from the way in which we develop properties rather than should present company accept it, go for the lowest possible price? So it's local labour, local supply chain, etc.
Okay, you did aim that at the panel, but yeah. I don't know.
So I thought I'd sit with the panel in case.
Can I take this one, Danny? Or do you want...
I don't know, I'd try and do that one. I honestly don't think we are in a strong position to export this yet, because we cannot say that we've housed our population better than other countries. They're in the smallest houses and smallest rooms, the sound insulation is bad and the cost is high. There's a headline, I think it might have been in the Times or Telegraph a couple of days ago, saying Empire 2.0, and we're going to go out again and into the world. I don't think we should go out unless we are fairly sure that what we have is a better model than elsewhere. It's my downbeat sort of take on that. But I sometimes do some teaching at the business school in Oxford for people doing MBAs. And the nicest business school students by far are the social enterprise ones. But, yeah.
Okay, shall I just touch on the social enterprise, because my own organisation over the history has been involved in setting up social enterprises. Also, they're, I suppose, small scale, but the impact in communities in the locality has been significant. And other colleagues in the room, and I was talking to someone earlier who is setting up quite a large social enterprise at some point, and I think it's training people who are leaving prison. So, you know, it's something that's strong in our sector. Again, whether we can export it, I'm not sure, because it's probably low scale. Peter, did you want to touch on the issue about value, generating value from housing?
I think we need to generate value from housing, quite clearly, but that value is what should be reinvested in communities. We need to continue to ensure that we're meeting the demands of future generations, not just the one that we're dealing with now. So value is an essential part of that, but I do think that the models need to be looked at quite critically. And one of the challenges we're facing at the moment is the government have said nothing about increasing any provision for an enhanced funding arrangement to support social housing and social housing development. And that gives us a problem, because I don't want to steal any thunder from Sean when he's going to speak in a minute about the combined authority role and what expectations there may be for having a housing pot, for the want of a better description. It's going to be a massive challenge, and it's not likely, I don't think, in the short term at least, to be able to respond sufficiently quickly to deliver the housing crisis that we're dealing with now. So, yes, we have to generate that value, and housing associations, I suppose the other point here, have a major role to play in that, alongside of obviously statutory housing authorities like mine and Sean's, and indeed the combined authority when that's up and running post May.
Did you want to
add to that? Yeah, I would like to add to that, because I mean, we have to realise the combined authority is 8 months old, so we're a relative baby in those terms. But I honestly believe that what we're trying to achieve is that atmosphere that will create that for the future. We've got to create something that allows that social enterprise to develop. I've been an independent board member of Watmos Housing for 7 years. It's tenant-run, tenant-led. It breaks down all the barriers that have been created through municipal housing, and that's not to knock municipal housing, because, to be honest, when I was chair of housing in the 90s in Warsaw, we were the worst landlords in the world, to be honest, and I accept that. So I think that what we need to achieve is what you're asking. And I think the point about value is I've already met the network of RSLs that have been formed in the West Midlands. They have a pot on year of £500 million to spend on housing. We could add value to that. We could work together to ensure that we make the best of that money. So I think it's exciting times for me, and I hope it's exciting times for the housing sector. And when I'm summing up, there's a couple of other things I'll probably add up as well.
Okay, fine, sure. Right, some more questions? Yeah, one at the back.
Hello, panel. My name's John. Thank you very much for a brilliant presentation, which I very much appreciated. At the beginning, you touched on tenancies and homelessness. Now, I'm a tenant in a Roundtree Trust property here in Birmingham, Casper House. It's the only one in the country built by the Roundtree Trust. There was another one in Leeds, but during the last 6 years. And I suffer mental health issues. And consequently, the rent to my landlord is paid direct to the landlord, not to me. Now, for a lot of people who are in rented accommodation and on benefits, they receive the rent and it's up to them. It's their responsibility to pass that rent on to their landlords. It fails. Consequently, we have a much higher rate of homelessness. And you only have to walk the streets of Birmingham. I don't know what the official figures are, but I know, and my partner knows, you know, walking around, we can count on two hands and more in one evening how many homeless people are sleeping in doorways. The policy was brought in by the government, I think the coalition government, possibly in the first or second year of the coalition. But I think it's a failure. A lot of people with certain mental health issues are not responsible for managing their income, and the money should surely go directly to landlords and not via the town.
Okay, let me try.
It's not a question, it's an observation.
I can have a view on anything, though. It's the danger of mine. I think I've been there. I think when it was built, quite near a canal. Where you're living, there are loads of things which are silly. So my children go to school. The government doesn't give me the money that it costs and then ask me to go and pay the school. It just pays the school directly for them to go to school. It'd be silly not to. But there are people in this government who believe it would be a good idea to do that. They'd like to create a private market in all schools. Yeah. Private markets fail for big ticket objects, housing, healthcare, and education, because sharks rip you off. Private markets are brilliant for buying small items. Socks is my favourite. You never want socks. And you can work out a continuum between large items, motorways, makes sense for the state to provide, and small items, it makes sense for you individually. And there's a point in the middle where it doesn't make sense to stretch the market. This particular government has had an ethos since the 1970s of believing that there is nothing that you cannot put the market into that will not improve if you put the market into. And we've done a massive service to the rest of the world of showing what happens if you do that. But I agree with you, but it's just working it out. Same with tax. You know, I'm taxed at source by my employee. It makes a lot more sense than actually paying me my whole salary and then asking me to go and pay. There's a whole lot of things where it doesn't make sense to give it to individual. There are also, you know, examples where a bit more freedom can save money, but in general, I think we see market madness here.
Okay, thanks. No questions? Yeah.
John Dalgenty from Industry Housing Association as well, so I've got to behave myself with my board member being in the room.
I'll go on.
Danny was just to come back a little bit to sort of the biggest picture of where the influence and change has got to come from, and to wonder about where does hyperlocal potentially play. So I'm really conscious of it because Industry, we're an Irish roots organisation, but we see our Irishness as being... we get the migrant experience. It's a platform for us to understand what it's like to come from another place. So we're working with new migrant groups now. And I've been exposed to groups of faith, sometimes faith-based people, people in neighbourhoods who are coming together, particularly around the community sponsorship of Syrian families. And it's like, it's something about people just thinking, we've got to do something which is the right thing in a very, very hyper-local way. So I suppose my offer is just to wonder whether that there's a place for that. You know, we might call it grassroots at another time, we might call it something which is about, you know, the power of individual, and maybe some of the work that Llewellyn and with Nehemiah UCHA does around communities, you know, whether there's a form that we've got which is not government and it's not, again, Does that make sense? Where can that play?
I'd agree. I mean, if you look at how green energy is generated in Germany, you know, it is communities coming together to propose schemes that then do it. So I am not for going back to Warsaw Borough. And one problem on the left is, and I'm obviously on the left, one problem on the left is that its solutions are commonly, let's go back to the 1970s. Right, save council housing, return to bog standard comprehensive schools. What left-wing politicians in Britain forget is that in the past they had ideas that hadn't been tried before, and these were new ideas, such as comprehensive schools. And when it was a new idea, it was a very good idea. But going back in time isn't so good. So I'm not for municipal state control over a population of 30,000-40,000 people, but look for the models in these other countries. The advantages the other countries have is that their governments stop sharks moving in into that area so that you can make something work. When it comes to Syrian families and children, though, you can be as nice as you want locally. If the government will not allow people into the country and won't even do that request to every local authority to say how many children they have places for, you're stuck. You are stuck by what your national government will let you do. And the countries which have more local initiatives that work better have a national government that encourages that. Our government are encouraging local initiatives such as free schools, which simply, we're getting a free school in my town, right? The first new secondary school must be for over 50 years in Oxford. Right, and it's the people in the poshest part of the town who are organising it, and it's going in that part of the town, because who else is going to get together and organise a secondary school?
Okay, thanks. I think we've got time for one last question, a brief one. I think that gentleman had his hand up first.
Very good. Well, most of the people from Nehemiah was the Bournemouth Village experience a flop?
What's Bournemouth? Bournville, was it a flop? My grandparents ended up in it. So I don't know enough about it, but they ended up going down the hill. You know the way you go down as you move, and eventually you end up in the nursing home at the bottom. I think the lack of pubs is a flop. As a teenager visiting the area. Because it was innovative at its time. This is my point. At its time, it was better than everything else that was going. You cannot hark back to models of the past. It was, you know, well-meaning, very rich Cadbury family trying to do something. That model was better than what we had before then, but you don't want to go back to very well-meaning rich people. We have it now in terms of Bill Gates. So worldwide, Bill Gates is vaccinating the children of the world. That's great. Bill Gates can vaccinate children of the world and it has an effect. What Bill Gates can't do is build a health service in countries with his money. So it was good at the time, but you need new models. We need new models. We have some that we talk about, but go and look at what they are doing in Denmark, in Belgium, in Sweden, in Germany, right? Rather than thinking that somehow, because we had the first industrial revolution, we are innately particularly inventive and we don't have to go and learn from anywhere else, right? There are reasons that we had the first industrial revolution that are not because of some genetic superiority of ourselves. And it's taken us a very, very long time to learn that we need to learn from other people. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Danny. Thank you for your... this point to Councillor Coughlan, who's leader of Walsall Council and Mind Authority portfolio lead
Thank you very much, Amanda, and I welcome the challenge from Danny, and I assure you, coming from Walsall, I won't make the same mistakes we've made in Walsall previously, and I can't force that on the Combined Authority for the West Midlands either. I just want to echo the words that Amanda made and just thank Danny for a fine and wide-ranging lecture this evening, and just to say on behalf of the West Midland Combined Authority, we welcome the opportunity to support this event in the region. It was interesting that Danny's lecture made some very interesting points. Some, I have to say, were the things that you would expect and the things that would drive me politically around how important housing is and the connectivity to things like physical and mental health, education, economic prosperity and community well-being. But it also touched on some personal things for me, and a couple of things that Danny said. He mentioned 1981 being that utopia time for housing. I remember I was a very relatively young man, 25 years of age, lived in a council flat, just become a father, and went to see my local councillor and said, we want a guardian for the child. My daughter, she'd have a guardian. So I knew the councillor, because I went to school with the same Catholic school as her children. And she said, look, Sean, you're a good Catholic lad. Come back when you've had five kids. That was the housing policy of Walsall at that time. The interesting thing was, because Danny mentioned the period of time in 1984, also in 1981, I was a coal miner. And I was there planning the revolution that took part in 1984 and gloriously failed. So I avoid revolutionary moves, and I'm a bit more developmental these days, I have to say. The ability to develop a strategic view on all the issues that Danny's raised tonight is really important to the West Midlands Combined Authority, and it's what we will try to achieve. The creation of the West Midland Combined Authority provides opportunities for housing to obtain a greater prominence in the devolution agenda in the region. And that's why I really fought hard to take on that role. It wasn't one of those portfolios that somebody said, all right, we're going to give you that. You had to fight hard for the ones that you wanted, and I'm passionate about housing. Ain't quite sure I know enough about land, because I've got all these developers phoning me up and testing my ears on numerous occasions, and I have to put them off. But we really do understand the importance of housing to the West Midlands and the wider conurbation. We've also already had the Mental Health Commission, which is reported on a range of actions that we are needed to develop to improve the mental health of our citizens across the region, and I'm really proud of what Pete Lowe's done as leader at Dudley in that portfolio. Transport and infrastructure investment is also a primary concern for us, because that connectivity to where the housing is, where the jobs will be, is really important to what we need to do across the West Midlands, and thankfully that's led by Roger Lawrence, who's not here tonight, but Roger Lawrence from Wolverhampton. But housing is a vital ingredient in attracting and retaining the workforce's need to accelerate economic development and to improve health and well-being and life chances. And it's interesting, but part of what we've just seen from the government, and even before the budget, to help us out in local government, the top slice, the new home bonus. So there's their intention already to what they believe housing should be about. Housing investment generates employment, both directly and through multipliers of the effects of the construction supply chain and ancillary industries. I have a very simple view of what I need to focus on in that portfolio area, and the two things, and Danny's mentioned one already, and in other ways others. It's people and places. It's very, very simple. And we overcomplicate things sometimes. And I was a bit critical of the housing minister when he came up to Birmingham a couple of weeks ago about the title of the housing white paper, because nobody's broken anything. We just have not managed the situation well enough centrally. And Danny was right. If we're going to make any changes, it has to be at that level. We will help them on the way, we'll show examples, we'll do the things that we need to do to make sure that West Midlands pushes that agenda as far as it can go. It's a bit like, I'm a big Northern Soul fan, I don't know if people know Northern Soul, but yeah, it's all about the vinyl. And you can have the best record in the world, but if it's been split down the middle and it's broken, it won't play. So it's about getting the best out that we can out of what we've got. So we move on to CDs and other things, technology, and technology will play a massive role in how we move housing forward. If we do it right, the affordability will be there, the modular homes, the way that we heat housing, the things that we do differently have to be at the forefront of what we do. But I've been reminded already on numerous occasions, we cannot forget, this isn't just about numbers of building new houses, we can't forget the houses that we already have. We need to ensure that they are the best that we can provide for our communities. So, despite the housing challenges we face, there is a reason to conclude that it's all part of the housing industry work together and in concert with wider infrastructure investment. And I would err on the side, it's in my notes here, I have to mention it, HS2, but I ain't quite sure. That is one of the things that will make us fantastic. A more prosperous regional economy and socially just society that can be built for the West Midlands. I thank Danny for the challenges that he set us, because actually that's the challenges we've set ourselves, and I hope that at some point in the future that I'll be able to come back, just as Danny will, and say that we've done the things that we need to do to make the West Midlands prosperous area that it should be.
So just a few final thanks from me. So thanks to Kevin, Dawn and Guy and the Human City Institute trustees for putting on the annual lecture tonight. I'm sure you'll agree it's been a great success. Just to say, the Human City Manifesto will be on the HCI's website tomorrow along with dummy slides. So please avail yourself of those. Thanks again to Danny, and just to say thank you to you all for attending. I hope you have a safe journey home.